Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Imagine you're in a band, and yes, you can play whatever instrument you want. If you wanted to record a song, right now you would have so many options outside of renting a music studio. Musicians are using portable devices, including smartphones, to record and edit digital tracks all the time. 30 years ago, you would have needed to book studio time or score a session at a friend's DIY recording space, and all of your tracks would have been recorded to physical tape. My own flame. And 80 years ago, music was recorded directly to a record plate that then served as the guide for any reproductions. You didn't really have the option to edit tracks after they were recorded. You had one take, and it needed to be perfect. From the archives of the Peabody Award-winning podcast, Radio Diaries, here's a tale of two recordings made on the same day in 1936 by two separate musicians in studios that were an ocean apart.
I first met Robert in 1936, same year he recorded. He wasn't famous at the time, just a quiet man, played guitar. My name is Honey Boy Edwards. I'm a guitar player and I play the blues. Back in them days, on a Saturday night, everybody would go up to that roadhouse, right down 61 Highway, have music, have barbecue, white whiskey, and we all started playing the blues together. That old boy sure could play a guitar.
My name is Bernard Greenhouse. I'm a cellist. I was one of the early students of Casals, and I spent a lot of time working on the box suites with him. Pablo Casals was one of the greatest musicians of all time.
My name is Paul Eli, and I'm the author of Soundabout, Reinventing Bach.
My name is Scott Ainsley. I'm a blues guitarist, and I wrote a book on Robert Johnson's work called Robert Johnson at the Crossroads.
My name is Billy Gibbons. I'm the guitar player for ZZ Top.
November 23rd, 1936. Robert Johnson goes into a hotel room which has been fashioned into a recording studio.
They recorded in the Gunther Hotel, San Antonio, Texas.
The record companies brought people from all over the West and Southeast to come and record gospel musicians, string bands, polka bands. I mean, they were just recording everybody. And so Robert Johnson's recording session was sandwiched in between a bunch of hillbillies and a bunch of sisters who played Mexican guitar music.
As the story goes, Robert Johnson was so shy, they allowed him to turn his back to the engineers so that he wouldn't be intimidated by the whole procedure.
He settled down facing into a corner, tuned up his guitar, and at some point they give him a signal to begin, and Robert Johnson starts to play.
The way his hand struck the strings, this was just one guy, one guitar, meat on metal on wood.
I got a kind-hearted woman, anything is worth for me.
On that same day, Pablo Casals walked into a studio in London. Abbey Road Studios was billed as the most advanced recording studio in the world. The technicians wore white lab coats, all the equipment was stainless and polished. So there he was, sitting in a chair. He was 60 years old and ready to make the recording that, in some respects, he'd been waiting all his life to make. He put his bow to the strings and began to play.
It was very difficult to get a recording in those days. They were on wax, the old recordings. There was no tape which could be cut. You couldn't patch a bad place. You couldn't play a run and have one note in the run missing and put it in later. You were alone with your cello.
There was an electronic light that they would turn on when you had to tie up the tune before they ran out of wax. 3 minutes. That's how much time you got on a 10-inch wax disc. Earlier recordings made by other bluesmen record a slice of a juke joint performance that might go on for 12 or 15 minutes. Verse, 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 and then cut off partway through because they'd run out of wax. Johnson had listened to enough 78, so he knew how long a record was. And so he crafted his songs with tighter lyrics and a better sense of telling the story.
3 minute songs. And Robert Johnson can sketch these incredible dramas of sin and redemption, struggle and loss. And you feel a world being drawn before your eyes.
You better come on in my kitchen. Cause it's going to be raining outdoors.
Blues is like a story. You say, I woke up this morning, my baby was gone. So I wonder which way did my baby go, you know what I mean? It's a simple thing, but you got to understand music. If you don't understand, you'll never be nothing good.
Pablo Casals discovered the cello suites as a boy in a dusty music store in Barcelona. For a long time, the suites were not an important work, a concert work. They were considered exercises, a way for cellists to learn how to play the cello better. There was something methodical about them. Casals was astonished by this. He played the cello suites and said, "These were supposed to be so cold. How could anyone consider this music cold?" Nobody thinks that anymore.
Back in them days, the musicians, they just pick up a guitar and play just like a mule trotting down the road. But they didn't have nothing to sweeten the song up, nothing at all. But Robert, he had a different style with the guitar.
That thumping boogie-woogie piano bass, dun-da-dun-da-dun-da-dun, and the chiming chords in the high part over a sustained boogie-woogie bass line, Robert Johnson figured out how to do that with one guitar rather than two. Whereas everybody else might have a rhythm guitarist banging along and then play the fancy stuff on top and sing, Robert could do it all.
I love my baby. My baby don't love me.
He had mastered a way of playing that went far beyond what anybody else was doing from the Delta at that time. It's downright befuddling. And this leads to the famous tale of Robert Johnson meeting the devil at the crossroads. Because, man, he must have gone somewhere and did something.
November 23rd, 1936 was a good day for recorded music. Pablo Casals had recorded two Bach cello suites. Robert Johnson had recorded two takes of eight different songs. An hour in London, an hour in Texas. And those 2 hours are as perfect a 2 hours of music as anyone has ever recorded.
After he recorded, his record was on every jukebox in the city. You could hear Tap Land Blues, Hellhounds on My Trail, Come On In My Kitchen. His stuff was out everywhere, and he had a lot of hit numbers at that time.
I believe my time ain't long.
A couple years later, in 1938, he got killed. He had been messing around with a juke joint owner's wife in a joint outside of Greenwood, Mississippi, and somebody passes him some kind of poison in a bottle of whiskey. And that's the end of Robert Johnson. He was 27.
Pablo Casals, who was already famous, became more famous than ever. He played at the White House, became a darling of the Kennedy administration. He lived into his 90s. And if there's one work by which he was known, it was his recording of the Bach cello suites. In some ways, the iconic classical recording of the 20th century. Meanwhile, Robert Johnson's recordings were pretty much forgotten.
Almost nobody knew who Robert Johnson was until 1961, when the first reissue came out on Columbia Records.
Everybody stopped in their tracks, just like, whoa.
I went to the crossroads.
Robert Johnson songs were covered by Eric Clapton.
I went down to the crossroads, tried to beg a ride.
Robert Plant and Jimmy Page with Led Zeppelin.
And of course, the Rolling Stones. The list goes on and on. Robert Johnson's small handful of recordings inspired everybody at that time. Well, it's what inspired ZZ Top's LaGrange.
Rumors spreading around in that Texas town about that shack outside LaGrange. You know what I'm talking about.
But as many times as a Robert Johnson number has been covered and re-recorded and reinterpreted, no one has yet recaptured what guitar players would refer to as that internal DNA. You can get the same guitar, you can probably go back to the same hotel room, but delivering it like Robert Johnson did in 1936, forget about it. It's not going to happen. That's what Robert Johnson left us with. Yeah.
I have been playing the Bach suites for pretty close to 80 years. I've played them this morning. But as old as I am and as much success as I've had, when I turn that record on and I listen to the old recording of Casals, I can still realize my own failings. Because he was the one who made it into a language. And basically that's what music is. It's a language which transcends all people and all parts of the world. And it doesn't make any difference whether it's Robert Johnson or Pablo Casals, whether you do it with the Bach suites or you do it with a guitar. That's what we all try to do. Make a language of music, a language which is almost understandable, word for word.
That story was produced by Samara Freemark and Joe Richman and was edited by Deborah George and Ben Shapiro. You can find more from Radio Diaries, including their backlog of 18 years worth of stories, at radiodiaries.org. You're listening to The Spot, the show that features the best stories from podcasts and independent radio producers. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. We just heard the story of a guitar and a cello, but have you ever heard a composition played on a hockey stick? Or how about on a prosthetic human arm? Next up, I have a selection from one of my favorite podcasts, Destination DIY, a show that champions folks who are all about creating and making all on their own, whether it's hacking the healthcare system or constructing a homemade spacesuit. In this particular story, the Destination DIY team meets an instrument maker whose approach to building is definitely somewhat out of the box. Or I guess, on top of the box. No, or with the box? Cue the ukulele.
D-I-Y.
Welcome to Destination DIY. I'm Julie Sabatier. Artist Ken Butler has some very specific guidelines for his creations.
What that means is that I'm using exclusively existing objects and transforming them.
But Ken finds that what might seem practical to him can cause some alarm at airport security.
DIY means doing yourself sometimes.
To Ken Butler, everything is an instrument, and I do mean everything. Producer Daniel Gross has the story of Ken Butler's unique blend of music, visual art, and what the French call bricolage.
When Ken Butler travels for work, he knows airport security will inspect his bag. It's been happening ever since the 1980s, which is understandable. He carries some weird stuff, like snow shovels, swords, large pieces of styrofoam, and an axe.
Believe it or not, I actually carried the axe onto a plane as a carry-on at one point, years and years ago. It didn't last too long, but they came into the plane to get it. I mean, I'm tempted to maybe leave a $20 bill in there sometimes, so please don't disturb these too much. But it's got to be confusing because it appears to be something mysterious. The objects are transformed in their purpose, and they look a little threatening.
Ken Butler doesn't look all that threatening. He's an artist and a musician, and he dresses like it, in glasses, Levi's, and zip-up hoodies. He'd have an easier time traveling if he just played ukulele or saxophone. But he doesn't restrict himself to the objects most of us see as instruments. He makes his own.
After 9/11, I believe the next time I tried to fly, there was a directive email. The following items are no longer allowed on airplanes. Canes, golf clubs, tennis rackets, hockey sticks. As you know, so it was virtually an identical list to the things I used to make the hybrid instruments. It's fairly easy to recognize what objects might make a good stringed instrument. You know, I mean, the classic would be a tennis racket. It looks like a small little banjo. And so I'm one of those nutballs who decided to, in the early 80s, actually put strings on a tennis racket and, you know, really, really trick it out to be very playable.
I caught up with Ken after he performed on his instruments at a contemporary art gallery in Berlin. He showed me one of his favorites.
I am holding a small snow shovel, metal snow shovel, that I found in downtown New York in the early 90s. I put three strings on it, three tuning pegs near the handle, and drilled three holes in the blade of the shovel and ran three guitar strings up. But due to the nature of the large, flat metal blade acting as a resonator, it has, you know, has some resonance.
Ever since he was a kid, Ken was a tinkerer.
As a kid, I built models of planes and cars in the 50s and 60s. And so it was some of the finesse of the detail of a very small scale axles and tiny wheels and gears and rewiring motors and soldering. Well, there are all these parts, and then you assemble them. And so that's the exactly what I'm doing. I'm finding the parts.
Over the years, Ken picked up a bit of guitar and violin, but he focused most of his attention on art. He got a master's degree in painting, and only in his 30s did he discover a passion that combined both music and art. This was the 1980s, and he was living in Portland. The house he shared had a fireplace, so there was a rusty hatchet lying around.
So I picked up the little hatchet. I immediately pulled it up under my chin as a small violin and thought, oh, that would be kind of a wacky sculpture. Somebody had given me an old broken half-size violin, and it happened to slide perfectly into a violin case. So I took the parts of the violin, the fingerboard, put the fingerboard onto the axe, glued it, and drilled a couple holes, and just room for two strings, and then used the chin rest on the blade. And I happened to have a contact microphone for my acoustic guitar. Put the contact microphone on the near the bridge of the violin, plugged it into my amplifier, and was, I have to say, rather astounded about how much it sounded like a lousy violin. that was the first of the hybrid instruments. And since then, I've made over 400 of them. And I exhibit them as sculpture, and then there's a group that I perform on regularly.
Ken had found the raw materials for what's become his signature style of sculpture and performance. Objects that fuse junk with pieces of broken-down violins and cellos. Instruments that make both music and noise.
It's different than a typical guitar amp, which uses a magnetic wound pickup to amplify the strings. So the contact microphone, the whole body of the, anywhere on the body of the instrument is touch sensitive. And so the touching, scraping, grinding, tapping, banging.
Redesigning designed objects taught Ken to appreciate accidents, like the accidental similarity between the body of a stringed instrument and the blade of a hatchet. There's a reason that guitarists sometimes describe their instrument as an axe. There's also a reason that children strum tennis rackets as if they're guitars. Ken started seeing these kinds of accidents everywhere.
I was interested in the relationship that the human body had to a guitar, the sort of head, neck, torso kind of look, without a concern for the acoustic properties of the object, more about the iconographic shape of that object.
Sometimes the instruments, also by accident, even match his wardrobe.
If you're wearing a pair of Levi's, the blade very conveniently slips into your pocket. So some of them are very Levi-specific. Ergonomic, the proportion of things and the sort of practicality of these objects and how they fit on the human body and sort of fit.
Ken started performing on his instruments starting in Portland in the 1980s. Soon, he moved to Brooklyn and he tricked out his act, adding effects pedals to diversify his sound, and even a looper pedal so he could accompany himself. He traveled around the country and even overseas to show his instruments, hence his many run-ins with airport security. Decades later, he still plays regular gigs in New York. By living simply and keeping costs low, he supports himself by hosting workshops, performing often, and applying for occasional residencies. He's a bit amazed at the fact that he's never had a full-time job. These days, his performances are built of layers upon layers of his different instruments. They're a sonic experience and a spectacle. Ken stands on stage with the blade of a hatchet at his throat or a rifle-shaped hockey stick jutting from his pocket. Sometimes the music is grating and complex, but even then, it manages to surprise you. Ken builds a philosophy to match his instruments. It's inspired more by theories of art than traditions of music. It's also thoroughly DIY.
What's at the center of the whole concept is the idea of bricolage, which is a French concept, very difficult to translate in English. The closest translation would be using what is, in quotes, at hand, repurposing or tinkering, but tinkering in English has a slightly unserious connotation. You know, old Mr. Johnson's over there tinkering around in the basement. Well, excuse me, but that's how they invented the airplane. What that means is that I'm using exclusively existing objects and transforming them.
Last year, when I spoke with Ken in Berlin, his work was part of an exhibition about technological art. It took place at the Y, a contemporary art gallery that looks like a whitewashed warehouse. We spoke in one of the gallery's cluttered side rooms, surrounded by tools, picture frames, and clothing scattered across tables and on the floor.
Now we're in a room that's full of junk. Is there anything in this room that you think would make a good instrument? You want to take a walk around?
Oh, I don't need to take a walk around because, drum roll, every single thing in here, with no exceptions, is an instrument. Can you name any object that's not an instrument? No, you can't. because anything that you can vibrate, you can amplify. You can take an eyelash from a bumblebee and put it in a little alligator clip and put a contact microphone on the alligator clip, run it into a little preamp, and then through an amplifier, and you could adjust the EQ and the gain, et cetera, such that you could tweak that little thing and it would sound like a thunderstorm or an explosion. So there is no such thing as an object that's not playable. That's the smart-ass answer.
He had a more serious answer, too. We were sitting next to a white mannequin, the kind that tailors use when sewing dresses.
So I'm seeing right to my left here a dress form, a torso, headless torso. It would make a really great cello. It's about 30 inches. So if you put a cello neck on that, you would have the right proportions.
Now, I poked around with that before you came in here, and it's made of styrofoam. So would that be a difficulty?
Actually, even better. Styrofoam is a fantastic resonator.
When you look at the world with Ken's eyes, you start seeing instruments everywhere. And you start hearing the music in everything.
In fact, if you take a little sewing needle and jam it into the end of a piece of styrofoam, find a turntable, have a record that you don't mind scratching a little bit, and just let that needle rest on the record. You can hear the music through the styrofoam.
Here's a bit of Polka by Frankie Yankovic, played through a styrofoam cup to take us out.
Thanks for tuning in to Destination DIY. This month's episode was produced by Daniel Gross with some help from the Destination DIY production team. The team includes engineer Brian Kramer, editor Laura Haddon, producer Jamie Cuddy, intern Sasha Peters, and me, Julie Sabatier.
DIY.
You can find more episodes from Destination DIY at MaximumFun.org or follow them on Twitter at Destination DIY. That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. Look at the homepage for the little blue letters that spell out The Spot. And tell me what you want to hear on The Spot. If you have a suggestion for a podcast we should feature, please drop me a line at thespot@kalw.org. Tune in next Thursday, same time, for a whole new episode of The Spot, only on KALW San Francisco.